53 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. There is a beach hazard statement in effect today through tomorrow morning for Lake Michigan beaches in Kenosha, Racine, and Milwaukee because of winds causing high dangerous waves. Right now, wind north at 17, gusting to 30, 53 degrees Kenosha, 48 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very, very happy that on this beautiful day, we can have with us in our WGTD studios Dr. Art Sear, such a good friend of the morning show, a monthly visitor to the program for lo these many years, the author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country and outside our borders as well. And Professor Sear makes time for the morning show to talk with us about a number of different topics and issues, always bringing his fresh and well-read insights into a whole host of different issues and concerns. Professor Sear, it's great to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's always a tonic to be here. Thank you so much, Professor Berg.
And here we are in the middle of finals week. I hope everything is going well for you and for your students at
yes,
this
indeed.
Busy time.
Yeah, I was fortunate to get the offer to come to Carthage College, which I readily accepted when my youngest son, Jay, was just starting high school. And as we get older, it's certainly more and more important to be around young people, and I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, speaking of a tonic.
As are you, young man.
Yeah,
yes.
Speaking of a tonic, it is that, exactly.
And it's going quite well.
Great. So ahead of us exploring some of your really interesting recent columns, I thought we would maybe start off by having you kind of talk a bit about this whole matter of the debt ceiling and the high-stakes negotiations that are currently underway between President Biden and leaders of Congress in terms of adjusting that debt ceiling and what happens if they reach an agreement, what happens if they don't. But I thought you would be a good person to maybe help sort out for us just what all of this is about for those of us not so well read on such matters.
Yes, we have a national debt and have had one from the beginning, with the distinctive exception of the Andrew Jackson administration early in the 1800s. President Jackson hated bankers. He hated a lot of people, as it turned out. The one president who verified killed a man, not long range, but close up and personal, at least one. He destroyed the Bank of the U.S., which the Federalists had put in place, and he actually paid off the debt. I think it was a little too terrifying for everyone around him, but wow. It was a traditional view that debt is bad, but we've always had a national debt. I'm not an expert on the subject. I've done a little research in anticipation of what I thought you might ask about. In World War I, Congress passed a debt ceiling law that requires there to be a formal request to raise the total level of the debt, which we've regularly bumped up against since then.
And just for clarification, are we talking about a ceiling that involves a particular dollar amount of debt, or
yes,
some percentage of our gross national product?
No, it's a total dollar amount,
okay,
as I understand the subject. There's an extremely instructive editorial in the Monday's Wall Street Journal by Phil Graham, now a very influential lobbyist and Washington personality, longtime very influential Republican senator from Texas, and a man named Mike Sullen, who's a fellow of the conservative, moderately conservative, influential American Enterprise Institute, and I certainly commend our listeners to that. It's got a point of view, but it's extremely informative on the history and the current to-ing and fro-ing. Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, who did a number of good things, in my opinion, for some reason he asked his attorney general to issue an opinion on federal spending, and that had the result of formalizing the fact that Congress and the executive had to reach explicit public agreement on spending. And I believe that resulted in the nonstop regular crises about spending and debt levels that there's nothing new about this particular confrontation. It's gone on really since the Carter administration. The president did a number of good things, I believe. He certainly sets a fine personal example, but there was a legalistic and moralistic bent to him that kind of think of the anti-Lyndon Johnson or the anti-FDR. He complicated life in some ways.
We're talking about Jimmy Carter now.
Exactly. Yeah, right. President during that the late 70s.
So we've had the debt ceiling for a while, but it sounds like for
since
decades.
Since World War I.
Right.
Yeah.
But it sounds like for a while then, for some decades, the matter of that debt ceiling, where it should be or whatever, in a sense could be handled in maybe various ways, but now it has to be handled in a rather formal and very public way, and that's why we are, in a sense, subjected to this spectacle, in a sense, time and time again.
I think that's well stated.
So what are the consequences, the real-life consequences, if the president and leaders of Congress are not able to hammer out an agreement? What's your understanding of what would happen?
We don't know what will happen.
Oh.
But it is very much a melodrama. It has happened before, in the sense that during the Obama administration, President Obama had to deal with the Republicans, especially House Speaker John Boehner, who, to my mind, was a much more flexible politician. What's changed in this century is both Republican and Democratic parties. There's been no sense of restraint on spending. It predates the pandemic, but the pandemic led to, in my view, very good public policies. Very generous federal spending, which our country can afford to relieve the impacts of the pandemic. But spending as a, and the increasing debt, spending as a percentage, the deficit as a percentage of the federal budget and debt as a percentage of our GDP have really rapidly escalated since 2000. Given that, in my opinion, it's very healthy that we're having this confrontation and the Republicans are providing a drag on spending. I hope that's clear.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't particularly agree with the Wall Street Journal editorially. I do think they remain one of the few actually traditional, reliable, professional newspapers in the country. And the editorial I mentioned as well, we're consulting from Monday.
Hmm.
It's a guest editorial, not their usually outraged, raging lead editorials.
quick question. So we've experienced certainly at certain points in fairly recent history, brief what get called government shutdowns, and of course
in the 90s,
right.
80s and 90s,
and I mean, it never at least seemed to be quite as dire as that label might suggest. I mean,
yeah.
It's not like every wheel ground to a halt, but there were certain consequences, and I'm sure painful for those directly impacted. Would those moments typically have revolved around this same kind of issue?
The government, it doesn't seem like it. Again, I'm not, I'm an academic.
Right.
Very much at this point. I'm not an insider or expert on real politics. Both sides are quite rigid. The parties have become increasingly ideologically uniform, which I think is a very bad idea. Most our colleagues, especially in political science, generally disagree with me. But I think one result of the primary system since the 60s is that the parties have become much more uniform and much less flexible at every level. And so this confrontation reflects that. I'm very disappointed in the president. I think he has an opportunity, as Bill Clinton, to some extent Barack Obama, but especially Bill Clinton, a very brilliant negotiator, again, a Democrat confronted with Republican majority. He very skillfully worked through what was essentially the same crisis in the 90s. Brilliant negotiators. In the 90s, a brilliant negotiator, clearly.
Right. It's interesting that President Biden, of course, once upon a time was on the other side of this fence. I mean, long career in Congress.
Yes.
And one might assume that that would equip him well for this moment and for this challenge.
Well, we all change as we get older. I'm certainly mindful of that. And the presidency is different. To survive, he does have to cater to a much more radical left Democratic Party than was the case when he first entered the Senate way back in the 70s. Precocious, very young senator.
Hmm. One last question. I want to get clarification on what
we'll
you were just...
As long, no rush. You're in charge, sir. I'll talk all day.
Right. We got other things to talk about. But
I hope so.
I just wanted you to clarify what you said about kind of characterizing the political landscape at the moment when you said something to the effect that the two parties are ideologically so much the same.
No, they're so much divided. The Republicans are a far right party. Liberal Republicans, especially in the Northeast, but also in Wisconsin and the West Coast, they've disappeared almost completely. Conservative Democrats, concentrated in the South but also found elsewhere, they've disappeared almost completely. The primary system, which came in after the tremendous violence of 1968, political as well as wider in our country, the primary system was brought in by the Democrats, and then the Republicans followed suit to make things more representative. Hubert Humphrey got the nomination in 68. He entered no primaries. Robert Kennedy and Gene McCarthy fought it out in an increasingly nasty, personal, understandably nasty, given the way Kennedy treated McCarthy, but a very, very nasty vendetta almost. But that was fought out in the public sphere. Let's have primary. The problem with primaries is not, so we have pervasive primaries today. The trouble is not many people vote in primaries. Single issue zealots on abortion, pro or con, on gay rights, on feminist issues, on religious issues, on Israel issues. You get single issue people, and that has had the practical effect of making the parties much more ideologically rigid.
Right.
It's an extremely important historical development. I tend to favor the earlier system, but at least in academia, I can assure you, I'm a minority, shrinking minority point of view.
So
that's fine. I'm used to it.
Right. So what you were So what you were saying is that each party is becoming, in a sense, more homogenous. Each party used to be themselves more varied.
Yes,
and that variation has really disappeared with this primary
system.
Exactly. Right.
And the variation opened the door for much more pragmatic politics.
Right.
And much more realistic politicians. And we see it at every level. We used to have politicians on the Supreme Court. And that led, what we have today are academics and activists almost uniformly. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, whom I admire and believe is the right person for that job, he indicates pragmatism. But basically, we have ideological zealots everywhere. Dangerous. The fanatic is dangerous.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear. And he joins us, of course, once a month to talk about various issues and concerns. And since we're, in a sense, talking politics right now, let's talk about the very, very interesting and informative column that you recently wrote about recent elections in Great Britain. I really appreciated what you had to say. I learned so much reading this.
Yes.
Well, I guess my attention to Britain has been fairly casual, and
shame on you.
Yeah, right. And you were talking in particular about the significant and to some extent surprising success of the Liberal Democratic Party there.
Yes,
and you kind
not
of
surprising, not surprising if you've read my work, sir.
Right, but I mean it was greeted as surprising by a fair number of people, and it sounds like this is, in a sense, shaking up what had been a fairly stable two-party system for quite some time and still is mostly a two-party system. But maybe you could sketch for our listeners a little bit of this really intriguing history.
Of course.
And in particular, the history of this Liberal Democratic Party, where they've been and now where they are now.
I did my PhD dissertation on the Liberal Party, the predecessors of the current Third Party. Traditionally, since the 1600s, the last time the British had a King Charles, the first who lost his head and the second who reestablished the monarchy with a lot of help. The current king is Charles III now.
Right.
They've had two parties, basically. The Tories evolved into the Conservatives, and then the Whigs became the commercial interests, non-aristocratic interests, crystallized around the Whig formation. That evolved into the Liberal Party. And it was liberals and conservatives into the 20th century. The British slowly, as they prefer to do, widened the franchise in the Reform Acts in the 1830s, 1867. Major enfranchisement of the male population generally. It went beyond property ownership around 1880, I think. And then in the right after World War I, women got the vote, as in this country, and working people generally were enfranchised. So everybody old enough to vote has the vote. And that fueled the rise of the Socialist Labor Party, which eclipsed the liberals. But they never disappeared entirely, and they started reviving in the 1950s and 60s. At the same time, nationalist parties, especially in Scotland, also in Wales, rose. There was a Green Environmental Party, which doesn't amount to much in this country. It does exist, but is very significant in parts of Europe, especially Germany. And the Green Party is also growing. But in the local elections, their parliamentary seats in the House of Commons, roughly like our House of Representatives, territorial seats. What counts is the general elections for the House. This was local elections, but the Liberal Democrats especially in last year and this year have grown a lot. They grew by about 700 seats in 2019, the last time these same local seats, it's a complicated system, were contested. And as the Guardian pointed out, the fact that they netted another 200 is really, really quite striking today. They were part of the government. The Lib Dems steadily grew strong enough that the Conservatives, to form a government, had to include them in 2010. So they were back in government power the first time since Churchill's party-wide coalition during the war. Between 2010 and 2015, they weren't a national coalition. So it's my subject. I could go on and on, but I hope that's a clear capsule.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
It is significant change in their politics. And the next general election, there's a very good chance probably Labour and the Liberal Democrats can and will form a coalition.
And that would be quite formidable, I should think.
It represents really significant change.
Yeah. How should we understand this term Liberal Democrat? I mean, are the British using either of those terms in the way that we understand those terms here in the United States?
Roughly liberals in the 1800s, the conservatives were traditional landowners, much more sympathetic to very activist government, including social reform. The liberals were a combination of free market conservatives, as we would say in this country, and very, very strong moral social reformers. Samuel Beer, B-E-E-R, I was fortunate he was my PhD dissertation advisor way back when. He wrote a book called British Politics in the Collectivist Age, which is still in print. And if you want to understand British politics, that's a great reference. You can get it at the library, $5 on Abe Books or Amazon. He really described brilliantly the historical evolution of their system. There is class-based politics, maybe the most important point. Class-based politics in Britain. It is really quite, except during the Great Depression and other crisis times, it's really quite alien to our system. But the British, one thing that struck me, I had the great good fortune to live there for about a year when I was a student working on my dissertation. The intensity of class feeling has faded, but it's really quite striking to an American, especially an impressionable student.
It's still there, in other words.
Of course. Yes, it is, but not like it used to be. Nonetheless, it was quite striking.
Yeah.
I mean, really striking. And the intensity, it's still present in Parliament. Watch question time in the House where the Prime Minister is on the griddle regularly. It's very, very intense. And the hostility between the parties is really quite striking. We're not, despite everything today, we're not like that.
Right.
I used to, before the Provisional IRA started bombing and killing people, late in my tenure there, you could just walk into the House of Parliament, and I would spend many hours at night in the House of Commons, even sitting around even the House of Lords. It was fascinating. It's a very verbal culture. It's extremely stimulating to listen to these people. But also the intensity of feeling was also striking.
Right. And, of course, part of it is, I mean, unlike our own Congress, where a lot of times when somebody is standing there talking, they're talking to a largely empty room.
Exactly.
And this is a crowded room, and people are talking back and forth in fairly unbridled fashion. Yeah,
yes.
It really is pretty amazing.
Yeah, the dynamics are completely different. You have to be quick on your feet. And Lyndon Johnson, enormously, perhaps uniquely powerful in dominating the Senate, throughout the 1950s, even though he was a Democrat and Eisenhower was a Republican, that kind of legislative power is just not conceivable in their system.
Right. A quick other point from your column. You touch on how the current... So the Conservatives have the Prime Minister right now.
But they're Rajiv Sunak, who is an Indian... from India, from South Asia, an investment banker who he's from an extraordinarily well-connected family, as is his wife, but at a very young age. They're increasingly common today on both sides of the Atlantic. He did extraordinarily well in finance. The Tories have had a real problem with leadership since David Cameron's misstep in having the Brexit referendum in 2016. It's going to be very interesting to see how effectively he does or does not survive.
Right. You mentioned in your column that one of the things that the Prime Minister is having to deal with is some of the leftover fallout, or whatever what you want to call it, from his predecessor, Boris Johnson.
Yes.
Can you just be a little more specific about what Boris Johnson left in his wake that the current Prime Minister is having to deal with?
Our very different systems tend to mirror one another historically, especially starting with the partnership between President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill in World War II, crucial even before Pearl Harbor. And the short, quick answer is he's their version of Trump.
Boris Johnson.
Yeah, very bombastic, very erratic, very un-British in many ways. He started out in local government. There, even more than here, there's a gulf between local political success, the mayor, county, city, town, county level, and national success. But he started out as the colorful mayor of London and then went on from there, a really interesting career. Hubert Humphrey, someone I admire a lot, started out as the very young reformist mayor of Minneapolis and went on from there to go to the Senate and almost became elected president in 68.
Right.
Incredible leader, very honest man. Humphrey is an example, but there aren't many in our system, but it's even more rare in Britain.
Of making that particular rise up the ladder.
Yeah, and Boris, he was able, after endless, it became very neurotic, kind of Freudian frustration related to Brexit, and Theresa May especially, hapless, brief prime minister, she worked and worked and worked to get a detailed Brexit agreement, and her own party turned her down three times, and she was gone. So Boris came in and said, "The hell with all these details. We'll just do it, and we'll negotiate it later." And he did it, and he won a huge majority in December a couple of years ago. And they still have the huge majority, but they're facing the apocalypse the next time they face the voters.
Right.
And Boris's style eventually really wears on people. Mm. And within the parliamentary politics, he increasingly isolated himself. Hmm. You know, wheeling and dealing and lying, and eventually it caught up with him. Hmm. So they've been losing steadily.
Right.
And he's out as leader.
Right. And your column also makes mention of the fact that one of the issues that the Conservatives are having to deal with is what I think you called in the column fallout from Brexit. That is, there have been real life sort of economic consequences for a lot of people in Britain in one way or another.
Of course. It had nothing to do with rational economics. Since the 1940s, Britain has become steadily more and more integrated into Europe in terms of investment, in terms of trade, in terms of jobs, everything. And they basically cut themselves off from their principal market by leaving, especially given the very irresponsible, cavalier way in which Prime Minister Johnson did it. The Commonwealth is a very important international organization. Diplomatic framework of the previous British Empire, it's very important in military terms, especially. But the dollars, pounds, and pence, the actual economic involvement is with Europe. So they have tremendous inflation. They've got very high unemployment. Individual businesses are suffering because they've suddenly been cut off. Truck drivers are losing their jobs because they no longer can move in and out of this very open market.
Hmm.
And a very, very brainy financier like Prime Minister Sunak seems to me to be ideal to try to cope with this.
Hmm. Well, we wish them luck. For those who just...
They'll survive. They've never felt close to Europe. When I was there, I was not a foreigner. I spent a lot of time hanging around with young leftists at the London School of Economics because it was so congenial, and they didn't see me as an alien American. Europe, even for Marxists, Europe is far away. You know, the States it's a tremendous legacy of the war. The states, you know, were part of the same family.
Hmm.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, sure is. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear, our monthly visitor to the morning show here on WGTD. And let's stick with Britain for just a little bit longer because I really appreciated
that
you took some time to talk about the coronation of, yes, indeed, King Charles III. And you've already touched on this in what we were talking about before, but I had not really remembered the legacy of the first two King Charleses, King Charles I, King Charles II, and back in the 17th century. And it's striking to think about just how volatile things were at that point in time. And King Charles III is reigning over a very different Britain than those.
Yes, of course. Well, Charles I was beheaded. It was a very revolutionary time. Religion was far more important than it was always important until the 20th century. And the Catholic sentiments of after the very brilliant, very overall stable reign of the Tudor family, Henry VII, wild and crazy Henry VIII, but then his daughter Elizabeth I, the Stuarts, who were much more sympathetic to Catholicism, even if it was not publicly decreed, came in. Charles I, very imperious, almost self-destructive. There was a revolution against him. He was tried, a kind of kangaroo court. He did have a trial, and he was convicted and executed of various crimes against the nation. They had a long and very bloody civil war. I mean, extraordinarily heavy casualties. Lots of social, it's very un-British, for lots of social radicalism, communal living, all kinds of wild things, not just politically. Very brilliant, very brutal. Military leader by the name of Oliver Cromwell took charge. He established a military dictatorship. He created stability. He suppressed nonstop rebellion in Ireland with the most brutal means. He also permitted Jews to return to Britain. The Jews had been banned from Britain, at least since medieval times. And so he was a very anomalous figure, but he did establish stability. After his death, the British had a very powerful reaction back toward tradition, which they've never left. And Charles II, the monarchy was reestablished. Cromwell was desecrated, literally. His corpse, Charles II, came back. Then James II, who was driven out in a peaceful revolution. And William and Mary from the Low Countries were imported, since the British monarchy was so chaotic. And the Windsors, the current family, are the descendants of William and Mary, who were imported after 1688. Fascinating history, but they got all this out of the way much earlier than other industrial nations,
right,
from my point of view.
I just have to mention that I don't remember how young I was. I was pretty young. I'm guessing I was maybe 10 or 11. And my dad, who loved to go to movies, was going to a movie one night, and I just begged him to take me along. I just didn't want to stay home. And so he agreed. So he took me to the movie theater, and the film he was watching, I'm not sure if it was called Oliver Cromwell. I know it starred Richard Harris, but it was basically about Oliver Cromwell.
Oh, great.
And there was a scene of King Charles I being beheaded.
Uh-huh.
And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I wonder if they tried to arrest the people who made this movie. I mean, I was so shocked that you could possibly make a movie that would have a scene. And of course, by our current standards, it was a fair amount of discretion was shown. I mean, although, you know, there's a moment where, you know, you kind of see this in the distance actually happen.
Oh,
and
good grief.
I see. But I mean, that was my introduction to Oliver Cromwell and to what he did. And, those were volatile times, to say the least.
And very, very bloody times.
Oh, my gosh. So King Charles III has come to the throne, and as you pointed out, this is a system that is so different from our own, and in particular this idea of the dignified functions and the efficient functions of government. What a fascinating concept.
I mentioned beer. I'll mention Bagehot. B like beer, A-G-E-H-O-T. Walter Bagehot was the very productive, influential editor of the very fine Weekly Economist back in the 1800s. And he wrote a book called The English Constitution that appeared in 1867. And he brilliantly described their system, and he made the basic distinction, which we don't have in this country, between dignified and efficient functions. Parliament handles the real business of government. And it's very intense, very adversarial, but also very businesslike. Leaders come and go. When the prime minister is out, the moving vans are there at 10 Downing Street the next morning, and the whole family is out and gone.
Yeah.
different from the presidency here, obviously. And the ceremonial functions, of course, all the people's emotion is focused on the monarchy. It's a very good, very readable book.
Yeah, and an interesting system. And, of course, one of the things you underscore in your column is that the value and function and significance of the monarchy is sometimes something we don't fully grasp here.
Yes.
I mean, we might sometimes carelessly characterize it as, you know, it's all about pomp and circumstance and surface and ceremony and so on, but there can be deep meaning, and particularly in times of crisis.
Yeah, speaking of movies, thank you very much. You and I probably should talk more about movies, and we get more listeners. The King's Speech, a wonderful. Hollywood still makes serious movies, a wonderful and pretty accurate film about George VI, a crucial leader, the partnership between him and Churchill, especially when Churchill was really struggling. I mean, really struggling at every level, including the impending German invasion right after he became prime minister. It brilliantly describes how George VI was able to overcome great shyness and stuttering and all kinds of personal challenges, and how he and Winston developed this tremendous partnership early on. The King and Churchill would go around together, especially to areas that had been particularly devastated by the Luftwaffe, and later on by the German rockets, the V-1 and the V-2, and the symbolism was really important.
And I appreciated in your column how you talk about how the media tends to focus on royal family personalities.
Oh, yes.
And I think you say this so
let's
well.
Let's not do that, okay?
Right. Yeah. You're right. There are much more durable dimensions to discuss, and hopefully that's what we spend our time doing today. So
I met Charles twice, actually, but I met Prince Philip, Queen Elizabeth's husband. He came to UCLA. You know, they're always touring the Commonwealth, and they come to the U.S., and it's always a big deal. I was an Army ROTC, and we were part of his honor guard. And the auditorium at UCLA was full of mostly older women. It's in a wealthy part of town. It seemed like endless well-dressed ladies from Bel Air and Beverly Hills and Brentwood were there. Philip arrived in this Rolls Royce that was so big, he stood up before he got out. It's the biggest
wow.
Rolls Royce I've ever seen.
Wow.
And then he had various flunkies, and I'm sure from the consulate there, running around and being very uptight. And Philip stopped and went down and shook hands with each of us. I remember it vividly, as you might imagine.
And that was a long time ago.
And he talked to each one of us. He was extremely, unlike his wife, he was extremely undiplomatic and was always shooting off his mouth and was very right-wing. So he talked to us, among other things, about why, how terrible it was they weren't backing us up in Vietnam. But he also asked us about what we were studying and talked about, quite honestly, about his great commitment to the military. And it was really quite moving. And the dignified functions can really have an impact on people personally.
Absolutely.
When he wasn't shooting off his mouth, he was extremely good in that role.
Yeah.
And you really, 20-year-old kid, you really influence people for better or worse.
Wow, that's great. A great story.
It was great, yeah.
Let's talk about the G7, which just met just a few days ago, actually.
Yes.
In Hiroshima.
Exactly.
And tell us about the significance of this organization, which has been significant for some time and continues to be.
Churchill and Roosevelt, speaking of the important two, basically established the United Nations. Even before Pearl Harbor, they had a summit meeting in Newfoundland. Before we were a direct combatant, we were heavily involved indirectly, including fighting German submarines in the Atlantic. But the Allies were definitely losing and getting clobbered. And these two courageous leaders met off the coast of Newfoundland. Roosevelt was already committed to doing whatever he could to get us into this war. And they established the Atlantic Charter, which evolved by December 41. Churchill came back after Pearl Harbor. Throughout the war, the reference was to the United Nations. The UN is a central, now global, set of institutions. And these other regional and other more specialized organizations are various offshoots of the basic UN core. That's the way to look at it. In 1973, Secretary of the Treasury George Shultz, with full backing from President Nixon, who had just taken us off the gold standard and done other major things, he was concerned about the tremendous destabilization resulting from the Arab oil shocks, and also stagflation was fully in, speaking of economic problems at the start of our talk, stagflation was making life difficult and dangerous for everybody. He got the finance ministers together from the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany. Later on, Italy, Canada, Japan, plus the European Union were added, and that evolved into the G7. And they've been meeting regularly ever since. For a while, it was the G8 because Russia joined, but after the, not the invasion of Ukraine, but after the annexation of Crimea in 2014, they were suspended. But it's evolved into a very, very important way for big economies to coordinate.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the column that...
In a very real, tangible way.
Yeah. You mentioned that the head of China has, in a sense, which is in China, not part of the G7, of course, has tried to engage in at least sort of virtual summits with the leaders of Brazil, India, Russia, South Africa. But you mentioned that not only do they not equal the G7 in terms of collective economic might, but that they are also not united in the same way that the G7 nations are united, not perfectly united, of course, but they really do, in a sense, present a at least somewhat united front.
He had some kind of virtual summit, probably via Zoom, which gives me a headache. I don't know about you. I'm totally zoomed out now. He had this virtual summit last year at the same time with the G7. This year, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, these very weak states that used to be part of the Soviet Union, he had a summit with these guys, about half a dozen leaders, which, again, symbolizes the fact that the G7 is strong. And the good guys are on the offensive today, unlike during the Cold War. So Xi, who's increasingly separated from Putin thanks to the invasion of Ukraine, Xi put together this summit of states that used to be part of Russia's orbit, but clearly now he feels there's opportunities for China to expand. The surviving communists are the imperialists, please note.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The world has changed a lot.
Yeah. And in fact, your column ends with these positive words. The dictatorships are on the defensive.
Absolutely.
Global momentum is with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's finish up. We just have four or five minutes or so to talk about South Korea.
Okay.
And then the recent visit by the head of South Korea, that was a fairly lengthy visit to Washington.
Yeah, and, six days.
Right. And it apparently, at least in part, was a commemoration of a 70th anniversary of sorts.
Yes, the treaty between South Korea and the U.S. 1953, at the end of the, when Eisenhower finally was able to end the Korean War. We have a security treaty that is extremely important. And at the end of the visit, I know a great deal about South Korea. I've been going there since the 80s. I met South Korean soldiers in the early 70s when I was in the U.S. Army. Another friendship to me, very much like the Anglo-American friendship. They are a tremendous American success story. Truman courageously decided to defend South Korea based on a UN resolution, one of a number of tough decisions, really tough decisions that president had to make. Eisenhower built on our successful defense through a comprehensive development program for South Korea. Ike was convinced that if we didn't do something dramatic, South Korea was so devastated it would fall to the communists. Anyway, even after he managed to get this ceasefire. And South Korea is a huge economic success story, as everybody must know. And since the mid-80s, it's been a stable and kind of wild, but stable and representative democracy.
Right.
President Yoon sang the American, classic American Pie. He actually sang it for everybody at the White House, which is a little unusual. Those guys are pretty serious in my experience,
right.
Not just in the Rock Army. But it's a very personal kind of rapport.
Interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. Everybody should go to South Korea. Right. There are always stars. If you've got kids in college or you're a teacher, the South Koreans are always at the top of the class. Always at the top of the class.
My treasured mentor from college, the choral director, Weston Noble, who was at Carthage for a while.
Yeah, you've talked about him often.
Yeah. He, towards the end of his career, he did quite a lot of work in South Korea that actually has a remarkably robust choral music tradition.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and he actually, unfortunately, fell and broke his hip while he was on one of those visits to South Korea. But he received, I remember him describing the extraordinary medical care that he received there. And he would talk about all kinds of other aspects of life in South Korea that were absolutely beautiful and so impressive. It's they're a good friend for us to have.
We were discussing our unfortunately late colleague, Yuri Maltsev. Ian, who passed away recently. Ian Johnston was a good political economy major and advisee of mine who's making his career in the U.S. Army. And Yuri, who kept in touch with our students and everybody else, took him out to lunch in South Korea a while ago. And Yuri was very impressed by the fact that the everything was on the house, whatever they wanted. And the restaurant owner, because Ian was in a U.S. Army uniform, he couldn't do enough, whatever you want.
Wow.
Take something with you. Okay. Come back. Whenever you want to come back, everything is free here. Whatever you want.
Yeah, it is a powerful friendship. And
indeed.
Of course, South Korea's rise to its economic greatness has occurred over a relatively short amount of time. I mean, you tell us back in the 60s, they were still a very, very poor country, but they are a
poorest
country no longer.
Poorest and most devastated, down below Burma.
Wow.
So when you're feeling unhappy about the wild and crazy non-events in Washington, why think about all the positive things going on in which the U.S. has played a role elsewhere.
Right.
Far removed from Washington, D.C.
Right. Good advice.
Thank you.
Dr. Art Sear, it is always a great pleasure and always enlightening to have you on the morning show. And I trust that we can look forward to many more visits in the future. And thank you for the time you've given us today on the morning show.
Well, I sure hope so. And thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to a conversation with James Schatzman. And many of you know him for the great work that he has done for Racine Vocational Ministries, now Racine Kenosha Vocational Ministries, that works so hard to gain employment for people who have just been released from prison and are trying to rebuild their lives. And Vocational Ministries has just celebrated a couple of very, very significant milestones that we're going to be talking about tomorrow. And on Friday, in the guest chair, will be our own Dave McGrath, WGTD's news director, to talk about his first novel, which was just published. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. sunshine in our forecast all the way through next Tuesday. Relatively cool today, a high of 63, and cooler than that near the lake. And we are under a beach hazard statement in effect all day today through tomorrow morning. And we'll remain cool tomorrow as well. Then we'll start to warm up over the weekend. We will see the 80s by Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News.